Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way this hour, a black man who's a husband, father, and also a cop. He gives his view of the relationship between officers and the community. Classes are starting once again, and many kids are learning remotely. But what about those who need the help of a school social worker?
I think it's strange for students to reach out via email and say that they need to talk to me. If they were in the building, they could just come down to my office and say, hey, do you have a minute?
We'll have that report. Also, we'll hear from a school nurse getting prepared as students in her district return to the classroom. And the pandemic is creating a lot of economic hardship. Are women taking the brunt of it? Those stories and more coming up on this week's Statewide. Stay with us. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, a school nurse gets ready for kids coming back during a pandemic. We'll hear how women may be bearing the brunt of the economic disruption and what it's like to be a black cop during protests for racial justice. That and more still ahead. Whether it's the global pandemic or social unrest, nearly everyone has experienced some trauma in 2020. Peter Medlin spoke to school social workers trying to figure out how to help students through this year, whether they see them in person or online.
It's hard to grasp the long-term mental health implications of COVID-19, but many Americans have already seen their mental health suffer during the pandemic. A study from the CDC found 75% of respondents between 18 and 24 years old reported experiencing mental health symptoms like anxiety or depression. Mary Ellen Spicer is a social worker at Sycamore High School.
A lot of our service providers in the community have seen an increase in adolescents, and then particularly ages 18 to 24. There's been a real increase on need and actual suicide attempts.
Spicer and other social workers, psychologists, and counselors will be on the front lines trying to provide mental health support to students starting school in the midst of COVID-19. Crystal Templin is a fellow social worker and counselor at Sycamore.
Often we deal with situations that are a crisis, and that's a given, but usually not everyone is affected by the crisis.
And the anxiety is coming from both the quarantine and lack of social interaction, and now the stress and uncertainty of whether a return to a social environment like the classroom can be done safely. Spicer's district just delayed their in-person start, and conducting social work online can present a multitude of challenges, especially when you have students with significant disabilities or anxiety. Sylvia Hudsick is a social worker in Rockford at Risa Middle School.
If there's some risk of harm, I mean, how do we assess that? And I think of my new students, I mean, am I ready to see their house? That's their space. That's their home base. I mean, are these families ready for that?
Fundamental work like teaching about facial expressions or how to come in and out of conversations becomes much more difficult to convey over Zoom or Google Meet. And students may have experienced a loss in their family, but feel uncomfortable reaching out. Trauma that students experienced during the pandemic doesn't replace what they experienced before. It just adds another layer to their story. And some students may have not even met their school social worker in person. Jen Katowski is a social worker at DeKalb High School.
I think it's strange for students to reach out via email and say that they need to talk to me. If they were in the building, they could just come down to my office and say, hey, do you have a minute?
Social-emotional learning is going to be front and center at some schools. Elizabeth Croning is a social worker at Gregory Elementary in Rockford. She says the spring was the definition of a crisis. So while they were sending out some materials, they can't blame parents for not being as responsive. Now, social workers are putting together presentations and using online learning platforms like Seesaw. They're focusing on coping strategies like meditation or getting outside and asking about good things that happened over the past few months, like spending more time with family. E-learning lessons also include links to community services like food pantries and housing.
We thought we were pretty we're all so virtual till this. And then it's like, there is all this stuff, but we don't use it.
Rockford Public Schools are still planning a blended part in-person, part online option. Sylvia Hudsick says about half of the district's families chose remote learning. So around half of her caseload will be online and the other half she will get to meet with personally. Social workers often fill their office with little fidget toys or stress balls students can use to relax, but now some school guidelines say they can't have shared items that need cleaning, and personal items are limited.
I have all these coloring sheets, you know, the kids come in and they kind of doodle because it kind of takes the pressure off of, you know, us sitting across from each other. So it's still like, how am I going to pull this off?
Social workers also have to help educate teachers on how to pick up on behaviors and building social-emotional connections even online. And as Sycamore's Mary Ellen Spicer calls, it's impossible for educators to help if they're not looking after their own mental health.
In March, I had a couple students who would be in crisis, and I'm at home in my kitchen on the computer with them, having to get a hold of mom on the phone, getting a hold of their case manager, and like trying to piece that together for the student. And then when I was done with that crisis and we had that student in a safe place, I'm still at home in my kitchen. So what am I doing to take care of myself?
It's unclear how long into the fall or winter students will be learning from home, but wherever they're at, social workers say they need access to mental health support now more than ever, even as millions of students in the United States still go to school with no counselor or social worker at all. I'm Peter Medlin.
As some Midwest school districts open with in-person classes, school nurses face a big challenge. They play a crucial role in keeping kids safe from COVID-19, and they have to handle many other health issues. A middle school nurse from Fort Dodge, Iowa, explains how she's preparing.
My name is Amanda Zimmerman, and I am a registered nurse here at the Fort Dodge Middle School, which is part of Fort Dodge Community School District, and this is my fifth year here.
It's something different every day. Never get the same thing twice with the kids. You know, we see not only medical issues, but mental health issues, psychosocial issues. I know that our plan is to come back to school. I don't remember what the latest number is, but you know, we did offer an online option to parents and students that did not feel comfortable putting their kids to school. So we have that. I'm excited. The kids need it. You know, there's so much more that goes along with school than just them being able to talk to their friends also. It's keeping an eye on those kids that maybe don't get fed every day, or maybe, you know, Iowa has pretty high numbers for child abuse. And since the kids haven't been in school, they've seen those reported numbers actually go down. And it's not because the kids aren't being abused. It's because the staff who were checking on those aren't seeing them. So I'm super excited. I'm a little nervous. I think everybody is, but again, we've put our plan in place hoping that we've created something to try to keep everybody safe.
Some schools obviously are checking everybody's temperatures. We're not going to do that. I would spend my whole day checking 1,200 kids' temperature and probably be done in just enough time to start over the next day. But, you know, if a kid comes in sick, we do have some protocols set up for if they meet certain criteria, what we will do with them. It's increased cleaning. And again, I said we typically see 120 kids a day in the nurse's office. So that's going to change. They won't be able to just come to the nurse when they want. The teacher will send a request. One of the nurses will go gather four students at a time. So two can wait in our waiting room. One can be in each of our rooms. That other nurse will be cleaning in between as those students leave. So it'll be kind of like a scheduled appointment so that we're not overfilling the nurse's office with students at one time. Parents are really going to have to give us good phone numbers and extra people that we can call because not every parent works in town, right? And we know that. But I can't have a child sitting in my office for an hour and a half this year either that might be symptomatic. So it's about, you know, who can the parents rely on? What can the staff do? Because obviously our nurse's office is not super big. And so I don't have an area that I can let all these kids hang out sick. And even if I do, we don't know that they have the same illness. So it's really about trying to keep kids separate, trying to do the best that we can. Even if we send them home, you know, a little early and we jump the gun, I think I'd rather send them home than have them stay and then infect another whole classroom. You know, I'm a little nervous because we've not done this before, but I think in everything that you do, if I was to start a new job, I'd be nervous, right? Because we all get that way when it's something we've not done. But I have a job to do. I'm a nurse. I know how to take care of patients. You know, this is what we go to school for. And so I'm not going to lie and say I'm not nervous because I am a little bit, but I know that we've done the best that we can for our district. You know, the school nurse's job is not just to kiss boo-boos when we fall down, right? A school nurse's job is actually, the definition is it's to do the best for the majority. And so with being in a pandemic, this is really looking at what's doing the best job that we can for the majority. And even if that means maybe a couple kids can't come to school because, you know, they're higher risk, it's what's doing the best for the majority of the district. I think everybody needs to just breathe. I think everybody needs to just take a deep breath and know that we're all in this together and that, there's so many unknowns still that we don't know, and we can't fix it all or solve it all in a day. So everybody just needs to go in every day and do the best job that they can.
That's Amanda Zimmerman, a registered nurse at Fort Dodge Middle School in Iowa. In Chicago, the highest number of COVID-19 deaths are in Black and Latino communities. Racism, pre-existing health conditions, overcrowding, and language access are all contributing factors. Member station WBEZ interviewed relatives of 50 COVID-19 victims for a series of stories. We hear from reporter Natalie Moore from the majority Black zip code 60649.
In mid-April, Jillian Woodbury went to the emergency room for a urinary tract infection. The 32-year-old lived in the South Shore neighborhood at Rainbow Beach Care Center, a nursing home for people with mental disabilities. Staff took Jillian to the nearby South Shore Hospital to treat her infection. First, she tested positive for coronavirus. All seemed well.
We talked late Thursday, all day Friday, all day Saturday, all day Sunday, and one time Monday.
But Jillian didn't call on Tuesday, says Patricia Woodbury. She's Jillian's aunt and guardian. Patricia called the hospital and was told her niece was on a cooling pad to bring her temperature down and a nurse would get back to her. No one did, so Patricia called before she went to bed and again was told a nurse would get back to her. One finally did in the wee hours of the morning.
The next thing, the phone rang at 3 o'clock and they said she had took a turn for the worse. And I lived down the street from the hospital, so I was down there in 15 minutes.
When Patricia arrived at South Shore Hospital, Jillian had died. She was not in the intensive care unit and had not been placed on a ventilator.
My assumption is that she must have passed away in her sleep because she was just had a smile on her face and, you know, laying in the bed.
WBEC analyzed COVID-19 deaths recorded by the Cook County Medical Examiner's Office. From March to May, during the peak of the pandemic, 60649 was the zip code with the highest number of deaths. Two-thirds of the hospital deaths were in neighborhood safety net hospitals that have fewer resources. Some avoided going altogether, with one man choosing to call an Uber to go to a suburban hospital with more resources. All had an underlying condition or disease, such as high blood pressure or diabetes. About two-thirds of the respondents said their relatives had some form of government insurance. Jillian Woodbury wasn't supposed to live past 9 years old. As a baby, she had an aneurysm. She endured many surgeries over the years and developed learning disabilities along with schizophrenia. In Jillian's 20s, she was diagnosed with obesity and diabetes. Even understanding the health challenges Jillian faced over the years, her family is troubled by her death and how they were kept in the dark initially.
My biggest issue was that the lack of communication between the hospital and the nursing home. When you test positive, why aren't you calling back to the family? As opposed, you call back to the facility, but then even with the facility, you don't notify the family.
Jillian's sister, Judith, also has developmental challenges and lives in a nursing facility in the south suburbs. And she, too, was infected with the coronavirus. On the same day that Judith tested positive, she also found out about her sister's death.
Tell me what you're going to miss about your sister.
All the fun stuff we did together and all the hugs, and she was a good person. It's not going to be the same without her. I'm sorry.
It's okay. No need to apologize.
Jillian laughed a lot and toted a toothbrush in her purse wherever she went, proud of her pearly smile. Patricia's daughter, Nicole Marshall, used to babysit Judith and Jillian when they were little. Today, Nicole is married in Ohio with children, and Jillian loved to play with them. This is the last voicemail Jillian left her big cousin.
Hi, Nikki. This is Jill. Calling the coffee to check on you and the kids and Kenny.
The whole of not having Jillian around is amplified by the inadequate hospital care Nicole thinks her cousin received.
While it technically isn't an issue of race, because the majority of families that end up going there are Black, and in the minds of some, that means you're disposable.
Jillian's story is not a proxy for how all African Americans died of COVID-19. But her family's experience with the nursing home and safety net hospital resonates.
Some of that is systemic, not individual. She ultimately became a casualty of that systemic disregard.
Monica Peek is a doctor at the University of Chicago who teaches and sees patients and researches racial health disparities.
There's no better perfect storm for pandemics sort of sweeping through our very segregated city based on race and class.
Peek says there's a COVID-19 risk based on place and the individual.
Although all Black people don't live in Black communities, all Black people are still Black. We're still at risk for the effects of racism and how that puts us at increased risk for chronic diseases.
Philip Thomas was an essential worker at Walmart. Every day, he took the bus from South Shore to his job in suburban Evergreen Park. He lived alone in a studio apartment. In this Facebook video, the 48-year-old is being silly and juking to house music. In March, Thomas didn't feel well and stayed home from work, says his sister, Angela McMiller.
The doctor told him to self-quarantine himself, which I'm super upset about that because my brother was a diabetic.
Thomas went to Jackson Park Hospital when his symptoms didn't improve after about 5 days. He was vomiting and had trouble standing.
So he didn't know at that time that he had the virus. He didn't find out he had the virus until the next day after he was admitted to the hospital.
The last thing McMiller said to her brother was, "You're going to be okay." Days later, Thomas's heart stopped. Natalie Moore, WBEZ News.
You're listening to Statewide, on the way, a Black husband and father on why he became a cop. That's next. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Still to come, the implications of canceling college football. That and more on the way. Next, Alani Benson found himself in the front lines in Ferguson, Missouri, after Michael Brown was killed by a police officer. But protesting alone was not enough. In 2016, Benson became an officer with the St. Louis County Police Department, following the former chief urging more people to join the force. Marissa Ann Lewis-Thompson of St. Louis Public Radio spoke with Benson and his wife, Kalia, about their choice as well as raising a Black son and what it's been like being a police officer assigned to cover protests. And a note, this interview was conducted prior to this week's events in Kenosha, Wisconsin.
I knew from that moment I always wanted to be a police officer, you know, way before the Michael Brown killing. There was just a motivational step right there, knowing that I could possibly get in and become a police officer. So I always wanted to be the change I wanted to see in the neighborhood. And now that I am the change, and I can say I am the change because people see me now as a police officer. And when I come to a scene or I pull up in front of your house and they're African American as well, it tends to, you know, settle the mood.
Has any of the recent tension between police officers and Black people make you reconsider being an officer?
First, I look at it as this is my job. This is what feeds my family. This is what provides everything right now for my family. Secondly, you know, it's always in the back of my head that these African Americans are being killed by police officers, and it makes the job very stressful. I have thought recently, like, wow, this job is overwhelming because I'm out here trying to do a job and I'm doing it the right way. And, you know, a lot of officers like myself get, you know, for lack of better words, get punished for some officer that does something thousands of miles away. But we have the job to do. And I suck it up and I put on a uniform and I go to work every day. Sometimes I don't want to go to work. Sometimes it's a headache. Sometimes I know that I'm going to be sitting out in 100-degree weather and somebody's yelling in my face about something that, you know, I feel strongly about and I know they feel strongly about. But I can't have that communication while I'm on a ride line. So sometimes I leave work with a lot on my mind because there's nowhere to release it.
And you said that it goes through your mind a lot, having to process both realities. Your job is an officer, but you are a Black man. How are you processing Black people being killed by the police, or profiled for that matter? Once you get home and take off your badge, you're with your wife and you're with your son.
Well, my wife would say I don't. My wife would say I don't switch hats, you know, because sometimes I paint a picture for my family because they're not living this, going to work every day, being a police officer. Sometimes I can like say things like, okay, baby, let's look at all the facts. Sometimes I say, let's look at all the facts. And then she was like, don't you just see this? Don't you see this? Did you see what it did? I say, yeah, I see it. It's wrong. But let's look at the facts. And sometimes I get caught in between that. You know I'm Black. You know, I look in the mirror every day. You know, I'm Black and I'm Black. You know, so I try to distance the two. And I try my best because, you know, at the end of the day, I'm always going to be Black. I'm not always going to be a police officer. But I'm going to do my job, you know, and make sure I do my job correctly.
Well, Kalia, I want to ask you, can you talk about what went on in your mind when your husband came to you and said, this is the path I want to take?
He first really expressed his passion was during the time of the Mike Brown situation. And I'm always going to motivate him and always push if I know it's a dream that he desires. So I pushed him and I motivated him when he was working out for the academy. All of that, I put my feelings aside about the police because I knew that this was something that my husband desired. I've had bad experiences with police officers growing up. My relationship with police officers is bittersweet. The sweet part is that my husband is doing it, and I know his heart, and I know his mind, and I believe that when he's out there, he's truly making a change. So my trust is with my husband. I cannot say that my trust is with St. Louis County. My trust is with my husband.
Are you comfortable talking about, you know, one of those experiences in which you did have a bad encounter with officers?
When I was in college, we had moved me into my apartment. And it was my father, my little brother, my mother, and my sister and I. And my father and my brother were driving the moving truck. And we were riding in the car in front of them. So we were driving in Jefferson County and we saw police trailing us, and then more police came and more police came. And so at this point, my dad called my mom and said, these are these police behind us. And she said, yes, she said, just pull over, you know, something's not right. So they pulled over and my little brother was asleep in the front seat. He was about 13 years old, 14 at this time. And they walked up and they put a gun to my dad's head and they put a gun to my little brother's head, and he was asleep. So he woke up out of his sleep to the gun. So just imagine if he was just would have woke up and grabbed something, just scared, because he was asleep at the time. What happened, the reason why the cops had pulled him over was due to the truck that we had rented was reported stolen, and the trucking company forgot to take it off. And so my dad was yelling like, you know, please take the gun off of my son. Please just talk to me. They said no. They were rough with my brother. They put handcuffs on him. He had marks on his hand afterwards. They're, to me and my mom, very aggressive. My mom was screaming. She was scared. She was just asking, can you please just talk to my husband and let my son go and we can figure this all out. We have paperwork to prove. They were very rude. They weren't listening to us. They weren't understanding. They did not release my brother out of handcuffs to the very end. I mean, at the end of the day, I don't know how police officers are trained. I mean, they could have been doing their job, but as me knowing
what police officers are capable of. That was traumatic for me. I was scared for my little brother. I was scared for my father. At this point, I just wanted them to let go of my brother and talk to my dad. I didn't even know how traumatized I was about that. So another time I was driving, and the police sirens went off. And I almost had like an anxiety attack. And that's when I realized that situation actually had traumatized me, that I was scared when I would hear police sirens drive behind me.
How do you hope to teach your son, and this is for both of you actually, how do you hope to teach your son about the realities of being Black in America when his dad's an officer, but you see footage coming out all the time about Black people in general and other people of color being killed by the police, and there is no accountability on the receiving end?
For me, I'm going to teach him more so respect, understand, and push yourself to be that change. You know, I get that this stuff been going on way before me, way before you. I get we need to see more African-American officers. You cannot expect people that don't understand your culture, that don't understand you, that never lived with you, that never had a 15-minute conversation with you about life, to understand you. I get we're all human, but we need more African-American officers. So we need to push that narrative, because when I, like I said, when I go to scenes, when I go to a house and there's an African-American family and they see me pull up, they talk to me. So I would teach him just to keep pushing that narrative that we need more African-American in any authoritative position, being a senator, governor, mayor. We need to start focusing on, you know, on that notion.
What I would teach my son is I want him to understand the law, know your right, know what can happen to you and what cannot. I'm going to teach him about the systematic oppression that African-Americans deal with. I'm going to have him read Jim Crow. I'm going to have him read Malcolm X. I want my son to be educated so he understands both sides. Yes, understand the law, but understand what's happening to our people, why we're in this situation right now. What is the why? And I want my son to be well-rounded. I know that when he goes to school, well, a lot of people have a bad taste about police officers. So he's going to feel his feelings will be hurt sometimes. People might say some mean things about his father, but I want him to understand, why are these people saying these things about your father? Understand where they're coming from in their environment, because you have a little bit more empathy and understanding.
Do you think that police departments, if there is any hope left in building that aspect of trust when that trust has been broken time and time again? Right now, you have people calling for defunding the police department or abolishing it completely.
A lot of this trust can be built. Promoting that narrative in the Black community to become police officers. We always saying FTP, the police department, but those same people call the police. You know, you call us for help. You know, I have been on plenty of calls where they'd be like, that's the police, you're Uncle Tom, you this, you that. I say, you call me here, man. You call me. You know, I'm here because you called me. Somebody at this address called me. So they need help. You know, defund the police is taken away from my son, taken away from my family, taken away from my livelihood. You think I'm gonna do this job if I'm not getting paid to do this job accordingly? I have a master's. I'm going to be working on my doctorate here soon, you know, and our department is paying me for me having a master's. That money will be gone. You think I'm going to stay being a police officer with a master's degree and a doctorate? I don't have to be here. I'm here because God is pushing me to do this, you know. So it's a lot of officers just like me. You think you have bad officers now, wait till they start paying us $15 an hour or they stop giving us overtime to work when we out there on the ride line. I think the application process is going to be very slim to none, because we want to do this job. I have to put on a smiling face when I don't have to want to put on a smiling face. I have to be professional sometimes when I don't want to be professional with the people that don't that's not professional with me or that's heinous with me, you know? So defund the police is not the right way to go, you know? We have to build another narrative. It's trying to coach our youth into, okay, this officer, he ain't no Uncle Tom. He's not an Uncle Tom. He's doing it for a purpose.
That was St. Louis County Police Officer and African-American Alani Benson with his wife, Kalia. And they spoke with Marissa Ann Lewis Thompson. A reminder, you can find all of our stories and more at statewideshow.com, and our podcast is available through the NPR One app. COVID-19 has caused several football conferences, including Illinois teams, to suspend their fall season. Chase Cavanaugh has more on the implications.
On August 8th, the Mid-America Conference announced it was suspending fall sports due to the coronavirus. This includes football, which is a major revenue and visitor draw for many universities. Sean Frazier is the athletic director at Northern Illinois University. He says the conference's decision was not taken lightly.
We've tried to hold out as long as we could to see if things would change, and we're seeing an uptick across a hot spot all across our country and in the world. So that piece of it is disconcerting.
Ultimately, however, Frazier said it came down to the health and well-being of the students.
We're talking about something that we can control, and we're already dealing with the uncontrollables right now. So making a decision on this fact to be able to safeguard young people is definitely a championship decision that I have to applaud the presidents and our lead for making.
Frazier said student athletes had a mixed reaction. Some were disappointed, particularly since spring sports had also been suspended.
There was a sense of relief, too, from some student athletes that had a lot of consternation about their safety, about how we were going to be able to safeguard them.
The economic effects are also expected to be significant. Part of that is to NIU athletics.
We're talking about a minimum of a $3 million overall was what we're projecting, with also probably about a 23% decline in revenue generation.
Several officials, including Frazier, have taken pay cuts, and the department is considering some layoffs. Damage extends further to the city of DeKalb and DeKalb County. Courtney Strohacker directs the latter's Convention and Visitors Bureau. She says the county earned nearly $1.7 million in travel and tourism revenue in 2018.
About 75% of that is really due to NIU, to the students coming in, to the college sports that happen.
And football game day drives other businesses.
So that means filling up their gas tanks, eating out at local restaurants, and spending money other places than just the games.
And then there are other universities. Following the Mid-America Conference's decision, several other conferences, such as the Big Ten, followed suit in postponing their football seasons. Kent Brown is an assistant athletic director at the University of Illinois. He said the school had prepared measures to address COVID-19, such as a saliva test developed by a chemistry professor on the faculty.
There was a lot of time and effort to put the very best protocols in place to provide quick response and safe responses to our student athletes, and it seemed to be working. But we also know that's not the case on every campus in the Big Ten and around the country.
Brown added that even without the cancellation, game attendance would have been limited.
Inside sporting events were basically with no fans at this time. Outside, we were given the ability to have up to 20%, so that was going to really limit the number of people who we could have at our football games anyway.
Brown said it's adaptation that's going to be key.
Our alumni and our students on campus, we hope that everybody understands this is a time period we all kind of need to be together and work through this plan so we can return to some kind of normalcy as soon as possible, and that's really going to be the only way we can do it, is to continue fighting the spread of the virus.
Strohacker says the same thing applies to businesses in DeKalb that get a lot of game day visitors.
And they're really excited because we have, you know, places like Facebook coming in and ordering lunches, and Syntegra and Ferrara Candy. So we might not have the students coming in and the football happening, but there's other positive things that are happening.
NIU's Frazier said the future of campus athletics and other events depends on taking proper precautions to socially distance and minimize the spread of coronavirus. If not, he said, the virus could devastate industries and activities that require face-to-face contact to thrive.
If you can lead from the seat that you are in and do the things you can do to keep everyone safe, this too shall pass.
But for now, those looking forward to the sights and sounds of the gridiron will have to wait. I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
We have more of Statewide ahead. Coming up, the impact of the pandemic's economic disruption on women. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll hear about college students moving back on campus with a lot of uncertainty about what the semester will bring. Stay with us. Well, this week, restaurant and bar patrons were told they now must wear a mask when interacting with servers and bartenders. That includes when employees take orders and bring food and drinks to the table, and when customers pick up takeout orders. The Illinois Department of Public Health Director Dr. Ngozi Ezike says those who think wearing a face covering is ineffective in stopping the spread of COVID-19 are wrong.
It doesn't matter what video you saw on the internet or the fake headline you read, please know that face coverings do save lives, but they must be used in conjunction with social distancing and hand washing.
Illinois has had a mask mandate since May 1st. The new rule specifically addresses interactions at bars and restaurants, which public health officials say is responsible for some of the recent spread of the disease. Reporter Maureen McKinney recently spoke with two economists who have looked at how the COVID-19 crisis has affected women and work.
Heidi Sheerholtz is a senior economist and policy director at the Washington, D.C.-based Economic Policy Institute.
In the world we live in now, women still have disproportionate responsibility for care work. It's changing. Men have, you know, over the long haul, taken more and more responsibility for care work. But if you look at how women and men really spend their time, women still have disproportionate responsibility for care work. And right now, that has really amped up with child care centers closing, schools being online or partially online, elder care services closing, just a whole host of things. So that means women who have been able to hold on to their jobs are also facing just this double whammy of I can't devote as many hours to my job as I used to because I now have all of this additional care work piled on top of me, which will further hurt women's opportunities for promotions, advancement, various opportunities and experiences that can have lasting effect. The nature of this recession is going to exacerbate pretty substantially existing inequality.
Elizabeth Powers is an economist at the University of Illinois Institute of Government and Public Affairs.
Virtually all married men with children work for pay. About 65% or so of mothers of very young children, 0 to 5, work for pay. So mothers were already the primary caregivers and giving up working outside the home to care for children. That was the arrangement. But now with the absence of childcare and the absence of school, in-person school, mothers are historically the quickest to leave the labor market when childcare needs arise. So this role is falling disproportionately to mothers. And so the impact on their work for pay is probably greater than it's going to be on men's work for pay, on fathers' work for pay. And that could lead to women losing a lot of the major gains they've made in the labor market over the past couple of decades.
Heidi Sheerholtz.
Women are more likely to be in education and healthcare, which typically are relatively sheltered from recessions, at least early on. So women typically, at least early on in a recession, don't face as much job loss. That has been absolutely turned on its head in this recession because the professions that got hit the hardest early on were professions that involve a lot of social contact, like restaurants and bars, hotels, personal services, events, brick and mortar retail, and women are disproportionately in those jobs. So women saw a big hit job loss wise early on in this recession. Women are also going to face greater job loss as a result of state and local government cuts because state and local governments are facing huge budget shortfalls, and because state and local governments can't run deficits, unless the federal government steps in with fiscal relief for state and local governments, which is looking more and more unlikely, tragically, state and local governments will have to make a lot of cuts, and that's going to really disproportionately hit women.
What are some of the other major impacts on women from the pandemic? Elizabeth Powers.
There was a recent study out of Yale. Since the pandemic, although men who work from home did more caregiving for children than they had before, the women who work from home were still giving plenty of childcare, and also now had taken on the burden of in-home schooling primarily, and were spending more time doing housework. So doing non-childcare housework. So I think already this has had, COVID's had a big impact on the kind of the allocation of women's duties. It's reallocated their duties away from the workplace.
Heidi Shearholtz, is there a particular demographic among women that's been hit hardest?
COVID, it's going to have even larger setbacks for women of color. We're seeing COVID is, that this COVID recession is hitting Black and Brown communities more. There's greater job loss amongst Black and Brown workers. That has to do with historic and current systemic racism that leads to occupational segregation and Black and Brown workers being disproportionately in jobs that saw greater job loss and discrimination and other inequities related to race that are playing out in the labor market. So we Black and Brown workers face a lot more job loss in this recession. Also, those communities have less wealth to fall back on. So there's sort of much more pain as a result of things like job loss if you're, say, a Black or Hispanic worker. But when you do the intersection of gender and race, if you look at what is going on with women of color right now, it's really bad. Like the job loss has really, really hit women of color, and in particular Hispanic women. It's just another layer of the how the COVID recession dynamics are playing out. I think we will see not just an exacerbation of existing gender inequalities. We're also going to see a great exacerbation of existing inequalities by race and ethnicity. And then when you put those two together, the people who are taking the hardest hit are women of color.
Elizabeth Powers, you spoke of the gains that were lost by women. How likely is that to be permanent?
I think it really is going to depend on how long this period of not having a lot of childcare and not having in-person school goes on. If this goes on for a very long time, women may become disconnected, more disconnected from employment than they had been. They'll tend to be the first in a couple to leave their jobs, and so they may have trouble getting reconnected to jobs once they have more time to search outside the home. Whereas more men may be able to continue with their employer or keep their work record pretty continuous. So this period of low employment, high unemployment, it's going to have a big impact on men and women. But women are likely to be out more during this period. So it's very probable that women will have some setbacks in coming back into the labor market when the COVID crisis finally starts to ebb.
Reporter Maureen McKinney spoke with economists Heidi Shearholtz and Elizabeth Powers about how COVID-19 has affected women and work. Nearly half of the Illinois cities that responded to a recent survey say they're considering cutting jobs or services. The Illinois Municipal League heard from more than 200 local governmental units about how they're dealing with lost revenue due to the coronavirus pandemic. Julie Moore Wolf is the mayor of Decatur. She says layoffs and furloughs are the last thing she wants to consider, but she may have to.
If we don't get help in a major way, I don't know how we recover. I can't tax my citizens more. there's just no more money to come back.
The Decatur mayor says the city is facing a $5.5 million revenue shortfall. Local governments told the Municipal League they're seeing less from sales, income, gas, and gaming taxes. The Municipal League is asking Congress to include money to make up for lost revenue in the next federal aid package. Students are moving in and starting classes at colleges around the country and in Illinois. Peter Medlin has more on the new rules and expectations of campus living during a pandemic and how it feels for students.
Move-in day is normally a frenzy. At large schools like Northern Illinois University, thousands of students descend onto campus. Student organizations pass around sign-up sheets in crowded dorms. Maybe even the football team helps unload furniture. Not this time. This year, students made appointments to move into dorms over the course of several days. David Lewis just transferred to NIU from a community college in his home state of Missouri. He and his dad drove in the night before to get an early start. He came for the political science department and the marching band.
Overall, I'm a little nervous, but I'm overall very excited to be here. It's a really good school and I wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
His dad, also David, has, like many parents dropping off their kids for the first time, some mixed emotions.
As a father, I guess I'm probably more nervous than he is. He's more excited. You know, I'm more nervous about him being in a new place, 6 hours from home, right in the middle of a pandemic as well. But I'm excited for him, and I'm extremely proud of him.
At NIU, they typically have somewhere between 3,500 and 4,000 students living on campus, and they're expecting about 1,000 fewer students this year. The college experience is built to bring students together, to meet new people and find your community. But everyone living on campus this fall will have their own room, both to allow distancing and remove the student density in residence halls. Mike Stang is the Assistant VP for Student Affairs. He knows this year will be different than normal, but he says they're trying to minimize those differences.
We're still working actively to create community in the residence halls, although some of it's going to be virtual. For example, every floor is going to have a community group that'll be set up through Microsoft Teams.
Stang says if students have to get together in dorms, there are capacity limits, and they should physically distance and wear masks. Also, aside from lobbies and dining areas, visitors are prohibited. NIU also set aside some rooms if students need to quarantine, but Stang says they'd prefer for students to go home if they can in those situations. John Murray was loading a cart helping his daughter move in, and he says it's hard not to think about other universities seeing clusters of positive tests after reopening.
Well, that's a scary part, but she's going to be doing some of her classes online, and some of them she has to go to labs and stuff, but the scary part is that you're more vulnerable here than somewhere else.
The University of North Carolina recently switched to virtual learning after it saw cases rise. The University of Alabama reported more than 500 confirmed COVID-19 cases. NIU made a substantial amount of their classes online or hybrid to discourage big groups. The university also made students sign a pledge to follow the community guidelines. But it can be much more difficult to ensure safety measures off campus where large swaths of students live. DeKalb Mayor Jerry Smith already acknowledged large parties on campus over the first weekend. Rockford University is a much smaller private school, but they've had to take their own precautions. Randy Warden is the university's VP for Student Life. They have 350 students living on campus, which is about what they expected. Over the summer, he says they thought it could be much fewer because of safety restrictions.
Students were willing to say, okay, I understand it's not going to be 100% of a normal collegiate experience, but if it's 70 or 75, that's good enough.
RU removed around half of the furniture in common areas. In classes, available seats have signs taped to them to try and ensure distancing. They've installed yards of plexiglass around campus. Warden says the issue for them is that because they're such a small community, people get comfortable around each other. And that comfort could lead to a false sense of security, and people could get casual about wearing masks and distancing. Whether it be large public schools like NIU or small private ones like Rockford, it takes more than just safety guidelines to prevent COVID outbreaks. It will likely take thousands of students, often independent for the first time, after having prom and graduation canceled, to sacrifice the college experience they hoped for since high school in the name of public health. And even then, positive tests and possibly an outbreak may still be inevitable. I'm Peter Medlin.
That's all the time we have for Statewide. We'll be back again next week and have more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Stay safe and join us then. We're on Facebook at Statewide Show, and you can always find our stories at our website, statewideshow.com. Our podcast is available through the NPR One app. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.